listen till my horse tired through darts and balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The rule book and calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 12, The Black Howl. She lived for a long time quietly and unquickly, without words. In the branches of the old brown trees, the worried birds and creatures watched in a trance of wonder. A body could not hit the ground like that and live, they knew, and they were observers of fine mystery, gleaners of arrivals and departures. They collected the shells of transition, rested near every bloom of life, and shift to death. But the girl in the glade was not dead. Not yet. Her heart tugged along beat to beat. Her left eye shivered open and shut. When it was closed, she slept. When it was open, she watched the wet figure of the firelight splash against the ragged woods. She could feel herself in different parts, in three places, all at once. She was the wind in slippers in the blown-down house of the world. She was the rocks and the sand and the dust and the sticks where she lay. She was a ghost in the deep hold of the earth. She'd hit the ground like a bag of glass. Her body punched a small X in the valley floor, like the letter of herself typed on the paper of the earth. She was held and surrounded by dirt, like a boot pushed down into it. But her left eye held at the fringe of earth, gripping like a lone finger on a cliff edge, to keep her from falling into the darkness. She stared at the campfire, took hold of the blaze with her staring eye. I am in three pieces now, Kittery thought. I am a ghost in the air with my father. I am a ghost in the earth with my mother. And I am the ghost of myself on the ground. She saw her father cutting at the kite string in the dark sky. She saw her mother falling into the hot steepness. And she saw herself, like a stone in the middle, tethering them all together. Over the loom of soil, she could see a trembling march of insects, one shade more living than the grass. Like the grass, they had no idea what they wanted, no thought of what they were searching for, and so always found it. Were they coming for her? But then she was gone, her eyes closed away into unconsciousness. It was a spellbinding, drenching sleep, and when she woke, it was raining. Grey marionette strings slipped all around, and the forest danced with little shoes. Leaves rocked, the fire bounced and ducked. But even as the rain fell harder, she saw the forest animals coming toward her. The birds stocked their feathers in the branches and lit down beside the fire to step closer. The squirrels bolted in with black-eyed terror. There were mice and clumsy moles and hearty toads and larger cat-like creatures slinking about the orange fire, coming for her with their wild, hungry caution. And then the animals fell around her, and she was in their shroud and felt their furred and feathered bones, like a blanket come to life. She felt herself twisting over and then rose up like a slab from the muddy print in the ground. She was rolled forward and then propped up, sack-like before the fire, suspended by flapping wings. On her lap, a quilt of mice, and the backs of small creatures below her legs. the animals retreated to the brown branches and darker folds of the forest to watch with shining eyes. This was the Ven of Wisdom. She somehow knew something about the animals, about the fire. Even her feeling of disintegration, of being a ghost in three places, pointed to this. Was guessing it was the Ven of Wisdom, itself a sign of wisdom. Perhaps she was meant to figure out something about the fire, why the animals had come to help, or something about her ghosts. In the pumpkin shards of the fire, she saw shadows form and break away, and soon the smoky shapes grew rigid against the brightness. There were black letters trembling in the flames. On the stone of the cliff, she'd seen the same thing. Words that weren't there, but words she could see just the same. And now, in the fire, a new rule was written, though it had no number. Was that wisdom? To see unnumbered rules on cliffs, or in the shiny ruckus of a fire? She whispered the new rule, aloud, to the animals and birds before her, as though they'd been waiting to hear it all along. Becoming what was, being only what is. She squinted in frustration, waiting for more, something else to help explain it. But the letters dissolved, and the rule disappeared, and she repeated it, so she wouldn't forget. Becoming what was, being only what is. Why were all her rules like this, so filled with struggle and confusion? Why couldn't they just say exactly what she needed to hear? If she became what was, what did that mean? Her mind wandered back through the different colored dresses of the last few years of her life. What had she been before? A little girl in a swamp? And before that, a baby in her mother's arms? And before that, hardly anything at all, and increasingly less. But had she ever been nothing? Was she ever not so? Wasn't everyone and everything always something somewhere? Even 1,000 years ago, she existed. In the bones of her ancestors, she was there, sleeping, imminent. Like the light of a star, she would forever be arriving somewhere across the distance of time. I have always existed, and I always will, she said to herself, not knowing if it was true, not understanding it if it was. Was she always what she was now, a ghost in three places, in the sky, underground, and on the earth? The pain of hitting the ground scratched thorns through her body as she pushed over onto her knees. And then she was standing, her feet disappearing in a brown, cold puddle the shape of her body. The pain rose to her eyes and looked out at the forest, and then fell through the floor of her being like a sickness. She vomited into the puddle and then stood and wiped her chin. Becoming what was, being only what is. She had no idea what it meant. She was a ghost in three places, that was all. She had not broken the glass of wisdom. She didn't know what any of it meant. Hold still. Haven't eyes to see below, nor the heart to really know what causes everything. When you fall into pieces, the burden increases, a helpless release, and then down into silence you go. Silence you go. The main hall in the White Palace was fit for a coronation. There was no doubt about that. As Mrs. Brushes led the villagers down one crimson walking rug and up another, they gasped and pointed out the royal accents, the marvellous features of the enormous room. Silver stick candelabras puffed the air with curls of sweet smoke. Chandeliers glittered from glassy chains, and snow-white sails drifted through the air like lost boats. The very scale of the room was terrifying. The ceiling was sky-like and retreated in a vastly hollow cathedral air. The distant walls, buckled with rows of gilded paintings, were so far off that none of the villagers could discern what exactly the red and black paintings were of. Landscapes, or portraits, or simply washes of colour. As they passed the fireplaces, reading nooks and snacking areas, and made their way to the centre of the room, however, a kind of nervousness arrived. Their whimsical exclamations ceased, their brows knitted, their hands made worried knots. There were peculiarities, subtle irregularities here and there. Was there not something a bit off? Mrs. Hench noted the lack of servants to Mr. Nundine. "All this food and no sign of staff," she said. She was herself on the casual lookout for a post as the palace baker, and was keen to make friends with any attendant who worked in the kitchen. Mr. Nundine added a concern about the acoustics. He tapped his foot on the marble floor beside the rug, and then said, as loudly as he could, "There's something wrong with the sound." "What's that, dear?" Mrs. Hench asked. She almost laughed when he said it again. He was trying so hard to shout, and yet all she could hear was a rubbery squeak of shoes dissolving in the air at his lips. "You'd think they might have a footman to take away the plates at least," Mrs. Hench said. "I can't hear you," Mr. Nundine said. He pulled his wild beard apart, wondering if it was impeding his voice. "I still can't hear you," Mrs. Hench said with a dreamy smile. "I wonder if the cook here is any good at bakery. I surely hope not. I'm so thankful that good cooks are often such bad bakers. It's been my wish since I was a girl to work as a pie maker in the palace." By the time Mrs. Brushes had seated them at the long table with the high-backed, purple-pillowed chairs, a handful of the more discerning villagers had noticed the sound problem. Mr. Wellfleet had all along been commenting on the lack of heat emanating from the fires in the open grates they passed. Both Mr. Twidbin and Mrs. Agard had observed that the double-vaulted door they had entered through was no longer there, and Mrs. Hench was not alone in her impression about the lack of servants. Mr. Dodge and Mrs. Bunkle complained soundlessly to each other that no one seemed to be listening to anyone else. "A great lot of mouths have come up hard against a great lack of ears," both of them muttered, a favourite expression of each. Mrs. Brushes placed them one by one into their seats and gestured toward the salted fog of meat and buttered bread. The villagers bent over their plates, but they were not hungry. "Something is very wrong here," Mr. Nundine said suddenly. He pounded the table and then stood. No one had heard him, so he said it again. His fellow citizens could certainly see his lips moving, and he was obviously upset, hitting the table like that. But it was hard to be completely alarmed in such a silence. "Did anyone feel the fires?" Mr. Wellfleet said. He stood up beside Mr. Nundine, as though this was the most likely way to be heard in such circumstances. "I waved my hand over each, and I must say, they give off a terrible dull chill. For fires, I mean." "Funny place to have with no staff anywhere," Mrs. Hench added. "I suppose we'll have to clear our own plates. Is that what anyone else thinks?" But no one could hear Mrs. Hench to answer. And soon they were all standing and gabbing silently in the air, staring at each other's moving lips on the very edge of confirming for each other just how terrible things actually were. It was at this most uncomfortable moment that Mrs. Brushes suddenly appeared and asked them to form a polite line. The coronation ceremony was about to begin. It was no relief at all to anyone that Mrs. Brushes' voice could be heard loud and clear above the table. The old woman brought them along a maze of switchback rugs. Though the floor was flat, something had punched up their thinking, and the villagers felt as though they were rising over small hot hills and then descending into cool valleys, even as they walked across the perfectly flat floor. They verged along the buckled wall of gilded paintings and could see now what was featured in their frames. Paintings of fire. Fire of every sort, hot red blazes, wicked yellow whips, bright blue daggers. And darker fires too, black and green and soft brown, smouldering pyres. Mr. Wellfleet raised his hand toward the wall and felt the heat pulsing from the portraits, and he staggered back, suckling burned fingers to his mouth. The darkness ruffled over them in shadowed wings from the corner of the hall, like a ripped hole in the earth. Mrs. Brushes turned and stopped them with a hard stare. "I will bring you in one by one," she said. "You will kneel and then bow to Her Majesty. Pledge the level of your allegiance and the manner of your bowing, and then raise your face and press it upon the monarch's outstretched fingers to mark your service." Mrs. Brushes smiled and then tugged at Mrs. Agard's sleeve to draw her toward the black well of the coronation. The two entered the void together and a moment later emerged. Mrs. Agard was pale and vacant, but smiled feebly at the group before Mrs. Brushes pushed her off on a course for the distant dining table. One by one, Mrs. Brushes led them into the mealy blackness before the monarch, where they pledged their allegiance and pressed their faces upon her outstretched fingers. Mr. Nundine, as was his way, was the last in line. When he staggered out from the hole in the wall, he fought to remember what he'd seen. The monarch had been wearing a small black crown, he seemed to recall, hunched on the floor, with the ceremonial trimus picus vermis set regally on her shoulder. When her eyes touched his, he'd crashed to the floor, and when he lifted his face, he saw the small, child's fingers floating brightly above his eyes, the only thing he could see. He must have pushed himself toward them, and when the fingers touched, his body twisted inside itself. His skin burned, and his heart halted, and his mind turned rapidly off and on. He stumbled then across the marble floor, nearly tripping over Mrs. Hench, who was quivering beneath a small snack table. The other villagers were equally beset. Mr. Twidbin was on his back, pushing himself along with one foot over the smooth floor toward Mrs. Agard, who was creeping beneath the wall hanging. Mr. Nundine's eyes blurred and then shut as he fell to the marble floor. He struggled to open them, and in the blear of light he saw the monarch and Mrs. Brushes walking in a room of fire. The glittering chandeliers were gone. The arched and distant ceiling was a glowing artery of small fires. Like two medics crossing a smoky battlefield, the monarch and Mrs. Brushes paused here and there before the fallen bodies to check for signs of life. When they stopped over him, Mrs. Brushes leaned down. She took his cold hands and pushed them to his throat. "You'll have to start a black fire now, Mr. Nundine," she whispered, almost kindly. "Mr. Twidbin's already got his going, and so have Mrs. Agard, Mr. Dodge, and Mrs. Buncle. Mr. Wellfleet has, of course, declined, and I'm assuming Mrs. Hench will refuse as well. It's up to you, of course, whether to make use of this great gift from Her Majesty. You know the consequences, I'm sure." Mrs. Brushes had always had a soft spot for the loud, bearded fisherman, and she spoke to him as sweetly as she could, and hoped he chose rightly. But Mr. Nundine wrenched his hands from his neck and drove them vigorously to his sides. He glared up at Mrs. Brush's his refusal. The breath ran out from his lungs, and his heart staggered to a halt, and he felt himself lifting off the ground. Behind Mrs. Brush's, the monarch peered coldly at him as he rose. "By all means," the monarch said, her little girl's face twinkling with wrathful delight. "Let us hear the song of your death, Mr. Nundine. Let us hear your black howl."
Walk to links of we, footsteps and snowbanks play yesterday. And how long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart, how long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart. Chains down from heaven, the snow builds a man. Burn down the figure and see where you stand. How long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart. How long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart.
Woolly sky beamed with stars, and Kittery walked beneath them. She drew delicate breaths through the broken cave of her chest, and the crooked pains in her back made each step small. The wind swam over the trees and turned the arms of the branches. The hand-like leaves swiveled and clapped in the high air. Kittery was following the animals, or trying to. When she'd finally stood before the fire, the animals had shot away. It was not a scattering so much as an exodus, a pointed departure that, however swift, felt like an invitation to follow. If everyone was going that way, she would too. The great trees rose beside her like painted paths into the air, but soon the canopy thickened and the leaves shut like small doors to block the starry sky. Kittery found herself walking in a pure and difficult darkness. The cool forest wind pulled her along, and she began to imagine lurking trees and stones and quiet gorges in the path ahead waiting to swallow her down. Her arms roved the air, and her feet tapped the ground. She was hardly walking now, for her worry of holes and trees and rocks. She groaned with the trouble of it and came to a stop. "This is silly," she told herself. If only she could see in the dark. "Close your eyes to see it." The words flashed in a double darkness for a moment in the air. She closed her eyes and looked. The inside vista was a different but equal kind of darkness. But still, the whole forest hadn't suddenly brightened in her mind. There was a difference, though, and she took a step to explore and find it. For some reason it was easier going this way with her eyes closed. She couldn't see the trees or the path, but neither was she imagining terrible obstacles. It was her opened eyes straining for substance, that had themselves created the phantom trees and rocks and gorges. But once her eyes closed, the illusion was gone. If Mumford hadn't mentioned his own power of insight, she wouldn't have guessed that the dark forest was the proving ground for the Ven of Insight. In itself, it was not terribly insightful of her. She had simply remembered something Mumford had said. In fact, as she looked back, she'd had similar second-wind-type experiences in each of the Vens. In the Ven of Strength, she'd uncovered her endurance. She hadn't flown in the Ven of Flight, but neither had the fall killed her. And now, in the Ven of Insight, she was using her body to sense the world around her. But it felt natural and physical, not magical, not a power. She couldn't see the future or guess what would happen next. She was soon slipping over the cool ground with her eyes peacefully closed. There were no girls swallowing gulfs or impediments. Though she could not see the actual trees, she could feel their massing, cold-packed trunks sorting out before her in the permission of a path. She guided herself more swiftly, running lightly through the forest toward the birds and creatures in the clearing just ahead. Here and there she ducked beneath low branches or leapt over a rock. All of these objects she felt in her skin, like a kind of intuition of the land. And when she slammed to a breathless halt, it was because there was something suddenly wrong in the air. She checked to make sure her eyes were still closed. If they'd opened, she might be creating yet another fresh illusion.
"Very good, I am impressed," the voice said.
The sick, wet air of his breath fell over her cheeks like a dirty cloth. Kittery took a step back, and he instantly followed.
"We'll do the next three Vens in quick succession," the minister said. "If you don't mind, I've decided to accompany you along to help you in my own grandfatherly way, as I did up on the mountain. The first is the Ven of Speed. If you'd made it to the clearing, the animals would have given chase. The lynx and fisher cat are especially quick and have quite sharp claws. But I am faster, and my claws are sharper. When you fail to break the glass of speed, we'll start directly on the seventh Ven. Off limits to the students of Tamerlane, the first of the dark powers, Kittery. The Ven of Death, which I shall have the great honour of personally administering."
She could feel his dead hands moving toward her, and she jumped blindly back and then bolted away, finding two trees and racing between them, and then finding two more. The minister laughed as his feet hit the ground after her. He was right behind her, his feet almost touching hers. But then he veered out wide into the forest, as though to build some distance between them, that he could then close the terrible gap and show her how truly swift he was. Her eyes closed further upon themselves, and then rolled back as the black trees hurtled around her. She let her arms tumble to her sides, and she leaned down further into the spilling darkness, each step hitting faster and faster until there was no ground beneath her feet, but a silk of wind hissing over her ankles. He was at the edge of her perception, bounding through the trees and crossing back and forth behind her. Again he darted away, beyond her ability to feel him, as though tired of the chase, as though giving up. And then he was gone. There was nothing but forest and the trees and the path she found between them. The branches ripped overhead and the wind tickled her feet. She was on the verge of agreeing with herself that she'd gotten away when she heard the airless punch of her own misery. She had plunged headlong upon his waiting fingers. He locked her upward on a twisting wrist in the quiet woods and turned her slowly through the air. His hand cranked and dipped deeper as the ends of his fingers rummaged for the redness of her heart.
"And there it is," he said, almost delirious with relief.
Kittery hung from his lifted arm like a tattered flag. As he worked his fingers around her heart, the minister began to moan with self-amazed pleasure. It was beyond words, beyond his wildest expectation, so rich, so vital, the taste running straight through to his bones. "Welcome to the seventh Ven," he whispered into her ear. He dropped her to the ground and resettled neatly over her, and once again pushed his fingers through her flesh to take hold of her heart. She was shaking now, bouncing against the earth, once again aware of her ghosts in three places, in the sky, in the depths, on the ground. The minister sighed with the trailing off of his pleasure, but then folded her heart upon itself like a bowl of soft clay, to ruin it again, to start again, to take what remaining flavour he could. When her body stopped and her last breath dissolved between her lips, the minister retracted his hand and shook it wetly over the grass. "And now, how sad for us both, we come to the eighth Ven." He was breathless, almost angry with completion. "I will tell you by way of incident and sharing that you are not alone in this. In Olive, at this very moment, the monarch has touched the entire village, and they all lay as you do, at the shambling edge of their own demising. Black fires, Kittery, are spreading here and there in Olive, hard smoke in the clear sky, and of course the fool is howling as well." The minister leaned down and spoke the wicked instructions into her ear, how she could live forever if only she would take her own throat in hand. But Kittery was listening to something else. "Can you hear it too?" the minister asked. He seemed surprised that she could. "You may mistake that for the wind or the ocean or a faraway song or the sound of your own self or silence," he said. "But that is the black howl, the very song of death itself, rising up from the dying villagers of Olive, those who refuse to start their own black fires. It will be your song too, Kittery, if you do not take hold of your neck." At first, when she began to slope upwards off the ground, she wondered if the animals had come again to her aid, to bring her to some new freedom. But there was nothing touching her now. The minister had set her arms in place and pushed her fingers to her throat, and she felt it soft and cool as stone. The minister nodded. "Yes, yes," he cried, and he clasped his own neck in demonstration. "With whatever strength you have, you must begin," he urged her. She rose higher over him, slowly turning in the sky. Her fingers caressed the counter of her throat, and she instinctively understood how to do it as she drew from her skin the first notes of the song. They flew out like hidden birds to chant softly in the air, like the whistling sound of wind in a shell. "Too late," the minister cried out, "too late." But even this gave him a great sudden pleasure. He watched her rising into the stars. "Of course, I hoped you wouldn't," he shouted, "but the monarch made me promise to try. She so wanted you, you see, wanted you by her side for the rest of time." She could see the stars above the sea, and on it, white matches striking the rough waves. She could see the grim black lines of smoke from all the black fires rising from the white palace in Olive. She gazed down at her grandfather as the black howl leaked from her flesh like a thousand whispered winds. "I forgive you, grandfather," she whispered in the song, to fill him for a moment with the intolerable grace of her forgiveness. "I do not ask for your forgiveness," he bellowed into the sky. He stormed a monstrous circle, the taste in his throat burning and vile. "I forgive you," she sang again. "I do not ask for it. I reject it," the minister raged. He spat upon the ground and stomped the place he'd spit and then dragged his tongue across his sleeve. He stumbled through the grass until he found a stone, and he reared back and launched it toward her, to strike again at that which he had already killed. "I forgive you," she sang, and the forgiveness fell upon him like a net to hold his hating flesh. He closed his ears and doubled down and retched upon the earth. "I forgive you," she said again. And upon this fourth forgiveness, she stopped rising in the air. The minister buckled on the ground, drawing his arms and legs to his chest in a binding of pain. The hat rolled from his head, and his face locked down into his ribs. And from his arching back, there came a long white rein that whipped upward through the air and spun a corkscrew around Kittery's wrist.
"The ninth, then,"
the minister screamed into the soil that filled his mouth. Kittery didn't know what the ninth ven was, only that she had broken its glass. She had finally found her power. I walk down the path through the woods, the falling snow. My neighbor, black as ice, a silver dream. As we go skating down the stream, reading devices for 99¢. Search for Kittery Embers on Amazon.com or visit ShowandSleeves.com or RadioGhost.com for more information. The audio chapters will continue to be available for free, but if you like the story, please consider showing your support by purchasing and downloading the three books as they are made available. Thank you, my friends.